You're listening to Green Mountain Medicine, an original podcast series by ACP Vermont for all things internal medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And we're your hosts.
This series aims to unpack the complexity of medicine in a nuanced and evidence-based way. We invite you to relax, grab some coffee, maybe some tea, maybe you're just a water person, and engage with us as we discuss the topics that impact our fields and characterize our practice.
Hi, everybody. Today, we're welcoming our special guest, Dr. Michael Stutzman, who's a nocturnist at UVM-MC. We're very happy to have you, Dr. Stutzman.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So to our understanding, being a nocturnist is kind of like having a secret life. You might sleep all day and then work all night. Can you explain to our listeners what being a nocturnist is like and what personality traits help you fit this role?
I think it kind of all boils down to I am there to admit people in between, basically in after hours, 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. You know, we're kind of on a skeleton crew, but people are still coming through the door and need to get tucked in. So that's kind of first and foremost the job. But there's other responsibilities that come along with that too. One of the other kind of big pieces of that is triage. The emergency department will call for an admission, and sometimes we kind of need to figure out the best place to put them. There's actually a lot of that work goes into that. Non-resident services have expanded really dramatically, actually, in the last probably 5 years since I've started as an attending. We've probably, I want to say, at least tripled our non-resident service. So that also means that there's a lot of cross-covering that we end up doing as nocturnists. I'd say the resident services are probably around, I mean, like 90 patients, and the non-residents can be up to around 40 to 60. So there's a, you know, cross-covering intern for all the resident patients, but there's two of us on at night, and one of the two of us have to do the cross-cover, and the other one kind of does more of the triage. One of the things I actually really like about nights is I do a fair amount of the rapid responses. One of us carries the rapid pager. We kind of switch off depending on the night. But I think relative to most of my colleagues on the day side, I do a lot more rapid responses because there's the person who carries it on the day side is the consultant hospitalist. So maybe my full-time colleagues will do maybe 2 or 3 weeks of consults over the course of the year. So it's far less frequent that they have to have that pager go off and hear the thing overhead and go running. As far as what skills make me suited for that, or, you know, what skills are most accommodating for those tasks, I think really anyone could do them. In fact, I know anyone could do them, and you know, any of my colleagues could do them. It is harder for some people to stay up all night than others. I think that's really the biggest thing, is if you tend to be more of a night owl, then it's easier to push through those kind of unpleasant hours between 2 and 6 a.m. to get those tasks done. Some people do like kind of the rounding format in their day-to-day. I don't do any of that. You got to like admissions. Some people really are more, again, like the rounding and find admissions less appealing. So I mean, being really inquisitive is helpful in that regard as well. I like starting the workup for patients. So when, you know, I'm really kind of hitting the bottom in the middle of the night, that kind of intrigue helps carry me through as well.
I feel like being a nocturnist is extremely difficult just because, like you said, you do kind of have bare bones of a staff during the nighttime, and then you have the same patient population, which is a little overwhelming. What do you think is one of the most difficult things about working nights?
Well, I guess I could answer it in two different ways. Really, physically, it is quite difficult, even though I am a night owl. It's really challenging. It wears on me. Some of my colleagues, it wears on all of us, I know. Some of my nocturnist colleagues, it seems a little bit easier for them, but I do know that it takes its toll on all of us. I have found that I kind of hit my max at a four-night stretch. I'm one of those people that needs about 7 hours of sleep or more to really kind of feel okay. But I'm finding as I'm aging, it's just harder and harder to get that throughout the day. So by my fourth night, my sleep debt is really kind of caught up with me, and I feel like I need to stop and take a break before I can do more nights. Some of my nocturnist colleagues, I mean, they're really impressive. They can do up to 12. I can't fathom doing that. But they prefer it that way so that they can have like a really, really nice raspy. I mean, they end up getting like 3 weeks, 4 weeks off in time if they do it that way. So, it pays if you can do it. But I can. In terms of like tasks, I find curiosity pretty challenging. And I think a lot of my colleagues would agree with that too. Regardless of what department we're from, everyone does want what's best for the patient, but it does tend to feel like, that old saying, all roads lead to medicine. And we end up kind of experiencing that a lot, and a lot more so than a lot of our daytime colleagues. Again, the way that we break down our work is there's a designated shift over the course of the day that's solely designed to address triage. They have the admission pager and, the ED or whomever calls them and discusses admissions. And that's, they have all of their focus that goes into whether or not the admission is appropriate for medicine or neurology or cardiology or surgery, et cetera. My daytime colleagues probably do maybe a month over the course of the year, if I had to guess, maybe two of those types of shifts. So they don't do nearly as much triage, I feel like, as us nocturnists do. And then meanwhile, we are also, we're doing the triage, but then we're also admitting people, and then we're also handling cross cover, and then the rapid responses when they happen, when there's a, every once in a while, there's a perfect storm, and all four of those things are really kind of getting out of hand, and that gets pretty unpleasant. But that's pretty rare. And when it does happen, we take it as it comes. We get through it.
It sounds like nights are very busy and you have to juggle a lot of things. So yeah, it makes sense that being a night owl is important to be able to manage the storm sometimes. So we noticed, Dr. Stutzman, that you did your residency at UVMMC and then you stayed here after your residency. And Katie and I have also noticed that a lot of our faculty that teach us have also continued on at UVMMC after doing a residency here. So we were wondering what led you to want to stay here at UVMMC?
Oh, there are a lot of things. Kind of boils back to when I was interviewing for residency. We are, I think, so incredibly lucky to be in a profession where basically we get to pick any part of the country that we want to live in, really. So when I was interviewing for residency, I was, I'd say this a little bit tongue in cheek, but I was shopping for towns to live in. And, I wanted to make sure that it was a good fit. The program was a good fit. Went from coast to coast. And of all the places I went to, I really loved Burlington the most. It was close. I really liked Denver. I really liked the San Francisco Bay Area. But Burlington was my favorite. And the residency culture, obviously, a supportive one. I didn't get any sense of, the toxicity that you hear about. The program directors were amazing. And the residents seemed as well rested as they could seem, as, for being residents and happy. And choosing that, I found in the last, 7 years now, or when I came time to finish residency, that was the right decision because the culture maintained true. I think it is in general very supportive, non-toxic, just good place to work. So plus Burlington maintained its, its appeal. It's just a great place to live. Those were some of the big reasons, I think. But also, honestly, after residency, learning a new system, after I spent 3 years training and being exhausted from residency, the idea of learning a new system really was just not appealing to me. I was ready to be done training, I guess. So that was one of the other kind of things that made me want to stick around. It's just so much, it's so much easier to continue working in a system that you're familiar with, as opposed to, moving across country and having to relearn the whole system and the culture. For example, whether or not there is some places there really isn't a dialogue between the emergency department and the internal medicine admissions. Sometimes they just, the ED says what they say and you do it, and that's fine. But, whether or not you're supposed to consult consultants for various things or not consult them. It's like learning those kinds of things, plus the EMR. It takes a lot of effort, and I just didn't really feel like it was worth it for me to learn all that stuff all over again once I was done with residency. I'm very happy with my decision.
I feel like I would be the same way, where you already taught yourself all these new things, and then now you have to go to a completely new place where they are like, no, we don't use that at all. We use a completely different EMR, which would be a little scary. But shifting gears, we looked up the hours of the Harvest Cafe. They're only open till 3 a.m. So we were wondering, what is your order from the Harvest Cafe? Or do you pack your lunch or dinner or whatever you would call that?
So, having done residency at UVM and basically the Living Off Harvest Cafe for 3 years, I at this point really try to avoid it. So, I mean, I think all things considered, it's good hospital food. But boy, I when I have to go to the Harvest Cafe, I feel like it's a sad state of affairs at this point. That being said, I do like their macaroni and cheese. That sustained me for a while in residency, but usually at 2 o'clock in the morning, that's not really an option. I usually at night just bring like a hodgepodge of snacks. Like my actually colleagues make fun of me because I'll like bring a baguette and like a block of cheese and like a, you know, a thing of olives and hummus and cucumber, and I'll just kind of like slowly graze over the course of the evening. If I really don't know what to do, then my go-to is actually I'll bring like an actual half gallon of milk and chocolate syrup, and I just make chocolate milk. That sustained me for a while. I don't get very hungry at night. I mean, it's so weird. Your body is so discombobulated. I think a lot of people tend to eat way more at night. I tend to eat way less. So sometimes I have to just be like, oh, I think part of the reason why I'm bottoming out right now is because I have zero glucose in my blood and I probably need a big thing of chocolate milk. Despite not being hungry, I'll just kind of make myself have a big glass of chocolate milk. That does the trick.
You'll probably have like a resident just drop a Nesquik like right in front of your desk
I say no.
That's so funny. I feel like I'm the same way, like getting food at the Given Bistro here at the medical school. I try to avoid it. And, you know, like if you see me in the Given Bistro, something has gone fairly wrong for me to be there. That's when I'm at my all-time low studying before exams or something. I try to avoid it. So speaking a bit to your well-being, you know, having food and sustenance is a big part of that. So working night shifts must be pretty hard. We're kind of wondering what some ways that you incorporate wellness in your life are.
When I'm on service, as I kind of alluded to earlier, it's getting harder and harder. I used to be able to sleep through the day without any sort of problem. Those days are becoming more limited, unfortunately. I'll try to go to bed by 10 a.m. I'll get home usually around 7:45 or 8 o'clock. And I need to go unwind for an hour or two, kind of turn my brain off before I can go to bed. But very often I end up waking up at about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock and I really can't fall back asleep. And it gets in this kind of stressful cycle, you know, I mean, with insomnia, like, oh, I'm going to be so tired. I need to fall back asleep. Otherwise, I'm not going to do a good job tonight. And it gets really tough. One thing that I found that helps is like, all right, well, I'm just going to get up and I go for actually kind of a quick run. And that actually, when I've been able to make myself do that, I tend to have way more energy over the course of the evening. So that's actually been a kind of a newer tool I've found when I'm on service that helps me kind of maintain some health and stamina. I think the more robust answer to your question is time off. One of the big perks about being a nocturnist is a full-time nocturnist will work, I think now it's 119 shifts per year. So that boils down to being about 11 per month. Our scheduler is wonderful and he's very accommodating. And usually you can kind of put that in any way that you want. Like I said, if you know, the people who are able to do longer stretches want to do 11 in a row, you usually will be able to schedule that for them, and then they can, you know, take 3 weeks off. For me, I'm kind of more on a four on and then seven or eight off. And I use that time to travel, and it really helps restore me. Like for example, right now I'm on a beautiful porch in Cape Cod and family friends, and it's just really quite restorative. It really helps me stay grounded and really appreciate everything that I'm doing and also just realize how lucky I am to be able to do all this stuff. Just enjoying the time off is one of the best things you can do for your well-being. And that is one of the big perks just in general about being a hospitalist, but I think it's even more so true for being a nocturnist.
That's awesome. That's great. I think that's so important to note that, you know, part of our identities has to be time away from the hospital, and hanging out in Cape Cod on a porch sounds pretty nice to me. So I hope you're having a great time there.
Yeah, that sounds really nice. I'm a little jealous. If you weren't an internist, what career path could you see yourself doing instead?
On the really tough nights, I often make jokes to my residents and students, like, I think I'm just going to retire and become a bartender and dive in Nebraska or something like that. And I'm like 90% kidding. It's like for some reason, that is kind of a weird fantasy of mine. But it really, the truth is, and I have thought about this because we've all had our bad days or, you know, bad stretches. And, you know, you wonder if there's, you know, you should have done something else. And I've analyzed it, and I really can't imagine myself doing anything else. And that's kind of a hokey answer, but I don't think I could do anything other than being a hospitalist, really. Primary care isn't for me. Doing a specialty isn't for me. I am first and foremost a clinician, so like administrative or research work, not so much appealing to me. So I really don't think that there's anything else I could do other than what I'm doing, which really makes me feel quite blessed.
I'm sure you have some hobby or a skill that you're great at.
Oh yeah. I have lots of hobbies. I mean, I love skiing. I love fishing. I play music. I don't think I would have any, I don't have enough talent in any of those realms to sustain myself, but
Not Ed Sheeran levels, but
no, I mean, if I were to, you know, have, you know, a genie in a bottle, that's what I would wish. But yeah,
I mean, if things don't work out ever, you could just open your own farm to table restaurant here in Burlington. You could supply the fish, you could supply the entertainment, and maybe bartend too. That's always a nice idea.
That's brilliant. I love it. Keep that in my back pocket.
Yeah, we can workshop it a bit too. What area of internal medicine do you think is changing most rapidly right now?
I think one of the bigger challenges that we're encountering is being geriatricians without being actually geriatric specialists. We're getting really good at keeping people alive for a long period of time, and learning how to manage all of the comorbidities is becoming quite challenging. And actually, I think a lot of reasons why patients end up on the medicine service as opposed to the cardiologist service, you know, or, you know, any of the other services, if they're just really medically complex, oftentimes people just kind of are like, okay, well, medicine's the best place for them. With that, we've encountered a situation where people are just very chronically ill and don't have the support out in the community to make it on their own, either family support, financial support, or whatever. So we are kind of becoming almost like a pseudo nursing home. There was a stretch earlier this year. It was really quite impressive where we had, say, at least 50 patients that really did not have any acute medical needs, and we couldn't figure out any sort of safe discharge plan. I think that's a problem nationally. And I think it's more of a problem unique to University of Vermont Medical Center, for better or worse. I mean, I think it's an expression of our overall compassion for people who don't really have any place else to go, and we're not, you know, callous and are kicking them out the door. But it is, in terms of operations, it's really quite challenging trying to figure out how to navigate that in a way that's irresponsible, in terms of just community resource management, but also, you know, being empathetic to the person and the family that's in front of you, saying that we don't have means to take care of grandma the way that she needs to be taken care of. That's a very evolving and challenging part of internal medicine, inpatient medicine, and I'm sure outpatient medicine too. But they often tend to spend a lot of time in the hospital when we're not actually managing acute medical needs.
Yeah, I feel like that's an extremely good point of how it's really hard to have empathy and then also like the allocation of resources and like wisely using them and how you can balance that, because that just from previous clinical experience, just like seeing how there's never any beds available just because people are there and using them. We also additionally have found ourselves on the UVM Medical Center Twitter account and found a quote by you. The best thing you can do for people who depend on you is simply to be thoughtful and present. A good laugh goes a long way too. I don't know if you remember saying that, but do you remember the last thing that made you laugugh?
I think in terms of patient encounters, the last good laugh I got was I was admitting this individual who it was in like mild respiratory distress. He was immunosuppressed. It was difficult to tell if this was like a pneumonia or heart failure or one of those kind of overlap things. But I decided I kind of wanted to come at it with all, you know, from all angles. And it's probably about 10 o'clock at night, and I was talking to him about diuresing him. He didn't have a Foley catheter in, and I apologize. It's like, you know, we could wait till morning, but the sooner we start making you pee, the sooner you can get back to where you came from. And I'm really sorry, but I think we should do it. And he's like, "You're not sorry, you SOB." You know, I'm truncating it. that got me laughing pretty good, and his wife. And then I said, "Well, yeah, you know, I guess now I'm not very sorry, but so I'm going to just do it." And then he started laughing, and it was pretty good. Yeah, you got to laugh or you'll cry, I think.
That's the new quote that's going on the Twitter next. Right, gotta laugh or you'll cry.
Yeah, in so many circumstances, it's just so much better to try and find the humor in these things.
Yeah, definitely. That sounds like a great strategy to have. I know one of my coping strategies is humor too. Otherwise, I would probably be crying more often. So we avoid that at all costs. We're wondering what a common misconception that other clinicians might have about nocturnists would be.
A lot of people think that we're antisocial weirdos. I wouldn't necessarily qualify myself as such, but I guess I don't know. You know, there's an episode of Scrubs where you know, they're getting mad at this person who's working all night in the emergency department who's just admitting everyone and just kind of this surfer dude and like doesn't really care about what they're doing and what he's doing. And I always kind of worry that we come across as that type of bunch, but really we like what we do. We like medicine. We like not being in the hospital and enjoying the sunshine. I think we're relatively normal people. The other thing is kind of what I was alluding to earlier is it is still pretty hard for us. I think it's easier for us to work nights than most of our colleagues, almost all of our colleagues, which is part of the reason we do it. But it is hard on us. I think that's another misconception.
That's so funny that you classify yourself. I'm a normal person.
I need to be really defensive about this. It makes me more abnormal by being defensive about how normal I am.
No, it's a good way to be. Okay. The last question of our interview. What was the best advice that you've ever received either from a mentor or like just in your life about medicine or about yourself or just about how to live your life?
One of the best pieces of advice I have gotten is kind of been passed down from my father's father to my father to me. And it's plan for the worst, hope for the best. It's, you know, kind of a common thing, but I do that's one of my approaches to medicine. One of my main approaches to medicine is basically contingency planning. I try and really encourage that in my learners. It's a fine line because I do have a tendency to go overboard with all the various contingencies of, you know, how things might go wrong. But if you do that, you plan ahead, then in the moment when things do kind of go off the rails, you'll already have a plan on how to approach it. So I really believe in planning for the worst and hoping for the best and seeing how.
I love that. That's a really sweet quote and another one to the Twitter because you seem to be very popular on there. Thank you so much, Dr. Stutzman, for talking with us. We know that you're on vacation, so we feel a little guilty that we're making you do this on a porch in Cape Cod, but we do really appreciate it, and we love talking with you and hearing your story.
Well, I think it's so nice that you're doing this, and it's really nice that you reached out to me. I'm very flattered, and I'm happy to have done this, so thank you.
Aw, thank you. Well, have a great rest of your vacation, and hopefully you get some sleep.
Oh, I will.
All right, folks. If you're still here, thanks for sticking with us. That's it for today on Green Mountain Medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our discussion, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @ACP_Vermont for more podcast updates, or subscribe to us on YouTube at Green Mountain Medicine.